This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. We're going to get you set for the Jets and the Devils 2 p.m. puck drop as the Jets look to make it a clean sweep of this three-game homestand before they head out on the road for four games next week. Alongside Dave Minuk and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. We welcome you to the program. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com. Gentlemen, move over Hockey Town. Move over Detroit. There's a new Hockey Town that's here in Winnipeg. The Winnipeg Jets 11-4-3 on the season, tied third in the NHL in winning percentage. The Manitoba Moose, after their victory last night, they're 10-5-2. They're sixth in the NHL in winning percentage, in the AHL, pardon me, in winning percentage. All of a sudden, they're the two Winnipeg-based hockey teams, professional hockey teams, are playing some good hockey as of late, Mr. Ginsberg.
Yeah, the Jets keep rolling, and you know, the game against the Philadelphia Flyers was not a beauty, Dave, but they found a way to win. You heard Blake Wheeler say it after the game. The first couple of periods, I thought, were pretty controlled by the Flyers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Matty Perreault's beautiful goal,
yeah,
on a beautiful feed from Joel Armia. Got to give Armia a lot of credit for that pass. But, you know, for the majority of that third period, you got the sense that the Jets were going to tie that game up. The Flyers, and they admitted it after the game, Sean Couturier admitted it, that the Flyers were kind of just hanging on for the lead, because that was a desperate team, Drew. I mean, they had lost the previous two games to the Minnesota Wild, shut out both games, mm-hmm, on the road. The Flyers needed that game. You know, Dave Haxtell, I think, is starting to feel the pressure, because this team right now is at the bottom of the Metropolitan standings, and they haven't had the worst start to the season. It's been kind of a 500, you know, a little bit below 500 start to the season, but, you know, the Jets found a way to win, and, you know, they continue to be dominant at home, guys. Since that game against the Columbus Blue Jackets, the Jets have not lost a regulation game at home, right? They lost the game to the Montreal Canadiens in overtime, but, you know, a very impressive third period. Overall, I wouldn't say it was the best game, because I think at times, you know, the Jets looked slow out there, and the power play, guys, was a big disappointment. That five-minute major, you know, given to Radko Gudas, the Jets couldn't capitalize at all in that first period, and they ended up going 1-for-7 on the power play, so the power play disappointed them. But at the end of the day, in a game like that, all you really care about is those 2 points. And, you know, Blake Wheeler makes a beautiful pass to Mark Scheifele for the tying goal, and then they find a way to win it in the shootout. And, you know, even though, again, like I said, it wasn't a Picasso, as Claude Noel used to say, you, yeah, get the 2 points, and that's what matters.
You know, most of the Jets' wins this year haven't been Picassos, and they're winning ugly. And I think there's something to be said for winning ugly in terms of, you know, Blake Wheeler's comments at the end of the game, I think, were most reflective about what this team now is. In previous years, he said they would have immediately abandoned their game plan after being down 2-0, would have tried to tie the game, you know, within the 5 minutes of getting down 2-0, and instead it would have obviously backfired, and they would have been very loosey-goosey defensively. Instead, what happened is they were down 2-0 very quickly. There was no panic in them. They certainly didn't abandon the defensive responsibilities, and they just sort of pecked away at the lead and were able to obviously get the tying goal with the net empty and on Mark Scheifele's goal there. And I think it's, Dave, is that sign of maybe a more mature team, that they no longer panic in the face of adversity like we've seen so many years previous?
I think so. And I think our guest in 20 minutes, Mike McIntyre, asked Coach Maurice about this after the game. And he said, you know, is this team now past the point where they try and score 2 goals in one shift,
sure,
to get back into a game? And I think the truth is that, you know, we all saw this team a lot, you know, over the years, and this team, I suspect, even last year, probably wouldn't have won that game after giving up 2 goals in the first 5 minutes. And you kind of had this feeling like when Philadelphia scored the first two in the first 5 minutes of the game, that it was like, oh, here we go again. This is going to be it's going to be a bloodbath. But the Jets have been playing well, so you're like, okay, fine, whatever. You know, you're entitled to have one. And then they didn't. They kind of held the fort at that point. And while they didn't get anything in that period, you thought, okay, well, they staved off giving up a third goal, which would have been really you know, deadly. And then they managed to do what, as you just talked about, which is, you know, claw back into the game and kind of maintain their position and then give them the opportunity to strike. So I think that's a game last year that they probably don't get back into. And I think it's a game that, you know, they probably would have been, quote, happy to get 1 point. And so they walked out of there with two. And again, that's Blake Wheeler's been talking about it for all season. He's talking about that those are the way that they have to win.
And even though the power play disappointed them, guys, the penalty kill really came through, especially in the third period, right? Brandon mm-hmm. Tanev, I think on one sequence, had three block shots. I think he ended up with four or five block shots on the night, but it seemed like, you know, three of those block shots came on that one power play that Philly had in the third period. And, you know, give them a lot of credit. Brandon Tanev is a guy that I think has really developed into that penalty-killing role for the Jets. And, you know, the penalty kill really came up big. Connor Hellebuck was very solid. I mm-hmm. think, you know, maybe in the first period, that wasn't his best first period, but I don't think you would blame him for those two goals. And, you know, they stuck with it, as Dave said. So, you know, again, you know, are you concerned maybe that the Jets, you know, are not getting off to the same type of starts they were getting out to a couple of weeks ago? The Jets have, you know, now given up the first goal, you know, in the last couple of weeks. You know,
yeah,
you
four of against, the last five right, games, I think yeah. they've given up the first goal.
Right, you saw it against Vegas, you saw it against the Coyotes.
Yeah, the first right. game against the Coyotes, yeah, absolutely. But to the flip side of that is they're no longer having the struggles in the second period
right.
that they had earlier in the year, where that was the narrative that they're getting, you know, destroyed in the middle frame. It all balances out, and I think to your point though, Ez, is that they just sort of kept their wits about them, and that's what's so, I guess, refreshing to see, is that instead of it immediately becoming a fire drill for the next 48 minutes after you go down two goals within the first 10 minutes or 12 minutes of the game, is you just they maintain their structure, and they're able to eventually. Now, they're not always going to be able to get that tying goal, and they're not always going to be able to do it, but I think more often than not, you're better off maintaining your structure, even if it means you might not get that tying goal sometimes. Ultimately, you're going to be more successful playing within your structure.
Right, and you know, you mentioned the word refreshing, and to me, Dave, it's just impressive, right? The Jets are 11-4-2, and you could argue that the Jets really haven't played their best over the last couple of weeks, right?
Certainly.
The two games against the Coyotes, you know, they outscored the Coyotes 8-2, but, you know, they maybe had two good periods out of those six periods, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the game against the Philadelphia Flyers, I would say that, you know, the Flyers, again, I thought they were the better team through, at the very least, the first half of the game. And, you know, the Jets keep getting these wins, right? So it's a combination of excellent goaltending from Hellebuck, who's going to start, obviously, this afternoon. We'll talk about that more next segment. But when you're talking about, you know, some of the goals they're getting now from Matty Perreault comes back after he's out of the lineup for a month. He gets a big goal. You know, they've been getting goals from the bottom six, Andrew Kopp, Joel Armia, right? And
yeah.
So you're getting goals now from not just the top two lines, because, you know, we obviously know that, you know, Blake Wheeler and Mark Scheifele, almost every single night they're going to find themselves on the score sheet. But they're finding ways to win. And Huss tweeted this after the game on Thursday night. Last year, you know, the Jets lose that game. This year, they get the 2 points.
They're certainly an opportunistic team, because to your point there, Ez, they certainly, I mean, Philadelphia was, I thought, the better of the two teams for the majority of the game on Thursday
night. And they
were
desperate, and you could see the desperation, especially in the first period. That was a team, you know, that had to get on the score sheet, because the previous two games, they didn't have a goal, right?
Yeah, they've been shut out five times in their first 18 games of the year, or whatever, right. We spoke about it with Anthony Sanfilippo on Wednesday's midweek show. And so, yeah, the Flyers were desperate, and they jump out to the lead, and the Jets, I don't think the Jets had a ton of great scoring chances in the majority of the game, but the chances that they did have, they were very opportunistic with. I mean, there was the Perreault goal on the beautiful setup by Armia, like you mentioned, and then Scheifele at the end there. I mean, there wasn't a ton of grade-A scoring chances. Brian Elliott didn't have to be outstanding. He was just solid, and the Jets were able to capitalize on their few A-plus chances.
Yeah, Brian Little had a really nice chance that he probably wishes he had it back, because he maybe took 1 second
yeah,
early. But
that's right.
But and the truth is, like, overall, Drew, I think you're right. I think the Jets just were opportunistic, and they really did kind of didn't elevate their game significantly, because I just don't think they had their legs in that first period, which is unusual for them, because, as you touched on earlier, they've been a good first period team. But again, those are the wins, and those are the games that you're going to look back on. And we've talked about this. I feel like last year we would talk about this kind of game. It would be a loss, and you would say, well, okay, you can always look to next game. But then at the end of the season, these are the games you point to, mm-hmm. having not secured a point. And you think to yourself, well, that's the reason why you're not in the playoffs. Whereas this year, I suspect if you know this continues, then you're going to be looking back on games like this and other games where the Jets haven't been at their 100% best. And, you know, like, let's be realistic. That top line wasn't the best line of the game for the Jets last game. And they can't be the best line every single game for 82 games a year. And they're still getting the points. They're still getting the wins, which is showing a little bit more of the balance that this team needs, because you can't be reliant simply on one line.
I want to hear what you guys have to think about the Gudas hit on Perreault. But first, here's Craig Button weighing in on what he thinks Radko Gudas should get for his decapitation attempt on Matthew Perreault.
You know, usually we go through the case and then give the verdict. I'm giving the verdict right now. 10 games. I mean, you have to be in control of your stick. And Radko Gudas is not in control of the stick. He comes right down and he'll say, oh, it wasn't my intent. I don't care. You cannot make this kind of a motion with your stick on the back of another player to the head. We're trying to crack down on slashing. This doesn't even qualify as slashing. That's a vicious blow that cannot be tolerated by the NHL. So he's a repeat offender. His last suspension was 6 games. So that's why I say 10.
Craig says 10. Gentlemen, quickly, as we're up against the break, how many games for Radko Gudas? He waived his in-person hearing. There'll be a phone hearing tomorrow where they will assess the number of games the NHL hands out to him. How many from your perspective, Ez?
10 sounds right to me. That was a brutal play on Matthew Perreault. Very dirty, and I do think his prior history is going to factor in here, so I agree with Craig.
Dave?
I'm of the 10 variety as well. I think that Matthew Perreault talked about it after the game. You know, said Gudas apologized in the penalty box, but when you watch the replay, you know, it looked pretty, he thought the intent was there. Because I think he was pissed that Perreault had just hit him in the previous, like a second before. Mm. And you know, he was obviously mad and he thought, okay, I'm going to get you back. And he, you know, hit him in the head. So I think minimum 10 is what he's going to see.
Dave, I think the worst part of that play is how vulnerable Matthew Perreault is.
Sure.
And Gudas, you know, comes down with the slash on the back of his helmet. Really, really dirty play. I might look like Radko Gudas, but I don't think that
condone that kind of action on the ice.
You got to give him, I think, at least 5, and most likely he's going to get 10.
We will find out Sunday or Monday when the NHL hands out their punishment. When we come back, we look at the Jets' forward lines with Matthew Perreault back in the lineup and the team at full health. How do you line up the Jets' forwards? That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Some sad news from the world of music this morning as Al plays some AC/DC. Founding member of AC/DC, Malcolm Young, has passed away this morning.
Oh, no.
Yeah, at the age of 64, he'd been suffering from dementia for at least the past 3 years. So, of course, we extend our condolences. We'll play a little bit of AC/DC throughout the show this morning. But Malcolm Young, if you're just tuning in, if you're a big fan of AC/DC, Malcolm Young of AC/DC passing away earlier this morning at the age of 64.
That's horrible news. As you know, Drew, I'm a big AC/DC fan. I've seen them several times, actually. The most recent time at Investors Group Field with Richie and our good buddy Neil Rockman. So terrible news in the music world.
Yeah, so that's putting a little bit of a damper on things this morning, but we'll get back into the Winnipeg Jets as we continue our look at the team as they're back to full strength now. Matthew Perreault, of course, coming off of the injured list. Should mention, of course, that this segment brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. For more information, visit Linden Market DentalCenter.com.
By the way, Drew, you know it's 8:20 in the morning when all that's on in the studio is soccer.
That's true. It is a big soccer morning here in the studio. Not a lot on other than that at this early hour. So the Jets forward lines, guys.
Arsenal's looking pretty good.
Matthew Perreault returned to the lineup, as I mentioned. He returned to the lineup on Thursday, and he sort of started off in a fourth-line role or in a bottom-six role at the very least, playing with Matt Hendricks and Joel Armia. I don't think anybody expects that line to stay together permanently, or at least even in the short term. So with Matthew Perreault back in the lineup, Adam Lowry returned earlier in the week, the team is completely healthy, especially up front with their forwards. How would you line up the forwards? We haven't seen a lot, 5-on-5, especially from Ehlers, Little, and Laine. You know, Scheifele, Wheeler, and Connor, not they haven't struggled, but they certainly are, you know, waning when they were waxing earlier, you know, a couple weeks ago with their performance. So how would you align the Jets forwards going forward with them team back to full health?
Yeah, it's a question that I really don't have the answer to. And I think right now you're trying to get a few lines going, Dave, right? And, you know, the Jets are now completely healthy, by the way, for the first time in a really long time. And it's, you know, really great for this organization to not have to worry about any injuries whatsoever. You know, no injuries on defense, no injuries at forward. And as you mentioned, Drew, nobody expects Matthew Perreault to stay on the fourth line. And I expect him to play on the third line tonight, Dave. Pardon me, today. And, you know, possibly move up to either the second line or the first line. That's what's great about Matty Perreault is that he's got that versatility, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I think that's certain is that he's going to stay on the left wing. And, you know, Matthew Perreault, when he came over and was signed by the Jets, you know, he was a natural center. But Paul Maurice likes to use him on the left wing. So, you know, when you look at that top line, I don't see Paul Maurice, you know, changing that top line anytime soon. But, you know, when you look at the Ehlers Little Laine line, you know, I was thinking about this, you know, yesterday after the game against the Flyers. And, you know, you wonder if Paul Maurice looks at flip-flopping Mark Scheifele and Brian Little.
Putting Little with Wheeler and Connor,
right,
and putting Scheifele with Ehlers and Laine.
Right, and I guess, you know, Mark Scheifele is going to remain the number one center, so more so it's, you know, Blake Wheeler moving off of the top line and Patrick Laine moving up to the top line.
And Nikolai Ehlers,
right,
moving up there too.
Right.
So a straight swap of centermen.
Right, and, you know, kind of the thinking there, Dave, is, you know, Blake Wheeler and Brian Little have obviously played together a lot dating back to the Thrashers days. And, you know, Little has struggled. He's played really well the last two games, though, obviously, picking up his second goal of the year. But to me, you know, you're kind of splitting up your two best players. Scheifele and Wheeler are your best two players. And so, you know, that's an option. But, you know, back to your original question, Drew, because you asked about Matty Perreault. And, you know, right now, I think you want him on that third line, you know, with either Adam Lowry and Brandon Tanev or Adam Lowry and Joel Armia. That's who I would ideally like to see as the third line, Lowry between Armia and Perreault. And that's what I was talking about in the offseason when I had that post for illegalcurve.com. And then, you know, if your fourth line is Brandon Tanev, you know, Matt Hendricks, Andrew Kopp, to me, that's ideally what your fourth line should be.
You know, I agree with you, but I do have to say I was impressed, especially the last two games, with the performance of Kopp, Lowry, and Tanev together as a line. I thought they were pretty impressive on the forecheck,
yep.
And I thought they were very noticeable even against the game in Philly, that they were, you know, aggressive and they were fast and they were on the puck pretty quickly. That being said, you can't have a bottom six that's devoid of what I'm going to say, you know, 5-on-5 offensive production. So if you're going to put Matthew Perreault with your, you know, your best offensive players in that bottom six, it is with Adam Lowry and Joel Armia. I agree with you there, Ezzy. I just don't know that Paul Maurice wants to break up any of these forward lines right now, Dave. How do you see this playing out? And is Perreault, Lowry, and Armia, is that a line that works from your perspective on a long-term basis?
You know what? It's interesting. I personally think that you've got to have pro minimum on the third line. And I think that the reality was that, you know, he played 10 minutes just because he's getting his legs back,
sure,
having not played since October 14th. So, I mean, he spoke about it after the game. He said it was the perfect amount of time. And obviously we saw, you know, that line didn't stay together. At the end of the game, Paul Maurice was kind of flipping it around, and I think he played with Armia and Little at one point. So there was a little bit of, like, mixing there. And clearly the third line was pretty good. I mean, they've been pretty solid for the last couple of games, as you guys just touched on. But, I mean, ultimately, I think, you know, this team is better served if you have Tanev and Hendricks and Kopp as your fourth line. You've got Armia, Perreault, and Lowry on your third line. But then the question becomes, what are you doing with the first and second lines? Now, the irony is we're talking about this as with the team that's won as much as they have.
Sure.
But, you know, it's always about tinkering to improve and maybe have more dominant games. And then the question is, really, to me, it's not that first line because, you know, they can turn it on and off, and they're, you know, one of the top lines in the NHL, I would argue. But, you know, it's that second line. That second line, to me, is just not gelled the way you would expect because the talent level just seems mixed. You know, you've got Ehlers who's got so much speed. You've got Laine who's more of a slower player in that regard, but he's more methodical, and it's just trying to find each other in those spaces. So and Brian Little is a great facilitator, as Ez touched on, and I think that he really does work well with Wheeler, but then the question becomes, how do you break up Wheeler and Scheifele, right? They obviously love playing together. They've got that natural chemistry.
Dave, doesn't it make the most sense, though, to put Laine on the top line with Scheifele? We saw how good they were together last year at 5-on-5, right?
Yeah, and I guess the idea could be that you put Laine with Scheifele and Wheeler, you flip them onto the left side, and then maybe have, you know, I mean, I don't, you drop Ehlers or Connor to the right. Like, I don't know how you're going to do it, but, like, it's a little bit, you know, it's a tough problem to have. You've got all this talent, but it's about matching it up properly, right?
Does Nikolaj Ehlers need to play with somebody, I mean, not at his speed because there's nobody on the team who can match his speed, but somebody a little faster than Brian Little, maybe?
No, I don't think so. I think Brian Little's actually pretty good for what he does. I think he can keep up. I mean, like, the reality is Nikolaj Ehlers is probably the fastest guy. Him and Brandon Tanev are probably the two fastest guys on the team. So it's not a function of, you know, in that theory or in that vein, really, as a player, you have to be able to – you can't be ahead of your line mates. You have to be with your team unless you really have a seam that you can take, right? So I just think that it's about adapting. And you know, that's a little bit on Nikolaj Ehlers. That's a forcing him to say, well, look, I can't be that far out ahead of my line because then it's me by myself trying to take on an entire defensive unit as opposed to me with my – you know, with Brian Little mm-hmm. and with Patrick Laine or whomever he's playing with. So it's about adaptability, and that's the thing. Like, you got to force yourself a little bit to adjust how your game is. You can't just, I mean, you can't always play to your strengths. Sometimes you have to look at the greater good, which is your line strengths, see what you guys do, and then meld your game to that.
Dave, I like what you said earlier. Maybe forget about, you know, flip-flopping Wheeler and Laine. You leave Wheeler on the top line. Maybe you flip-flop Connor and Ehlers, right? And, you know, I mean, let's be honest, guys. The Ehlers Little line,
well, and then you're getting back to the Schwielers line, like that you like.
Well, absolutely, and you know, and then you know, Connor's been hot lately, and you hope that you know it rubs off on Brian Little. He's able to get you know Connor the puck, and you know what Laine can do. And I mean, there's no shortage of talent in the top six. And Connor, Scheifele, and Wheeler, although they've been the best line at times lately, Ehlers Little and Laine have been the Jets' best line. And guys, you know they're going to break out. I mean, I think they're going to break out. If this line stays together, you know the goals are going to come. At least you expect the goals to come.
I just haven't seen it 5-on-5, though, Ez. I just haven't seen the chemistry between that line.
And isn't it puzzling, though? I mean, like the fact that, you know, we know how good Laine's been on the power play, and Nikolaj Ehlers has been great the whole season. But 5-on-5, it's really baffling to me that this line hasn't been better.
I agree. And you know, I don't mind the idea of maybe moving Ehlers up there and putting Connor down a bit. You know, something about it I just think needs to be recalibrated to some degree. At some point in time, it gets a little bit stale. I mean, I know it doesn't. Look, it's not going to last long. I think ultimately, you know, you're going to. Scheifele and Wheeler are pretty much going to be like Getzlaff and Perry, that they're going to be playing together the majority of the season, no matter what else happens and no matter what other shuffling happens. Those two guys always end up together.
Yeah, and again, we're just a radio show here, and Paul Maurice is obviously the coach, but, you know, you wonder if, you know, maybe they should put Laine and Scheifele together. I mean, look at the numbers, and we talked about it, you know, early on in the season, mm-hmm. in the preseason. You know, Scheifele and Laine, 5-on-5, are dynamite.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I just think at this point, I think right now, this might not be a bad opportunity. I don't know if it's going to be today necessarily, but maybe on this, as you go on this road trip, to maybe try and shuffle things around just a little bit,
right.
not you know, wholesale changes, but maybe move Laine up or move Ehlers up and maybe just try and rejuvenate everybody a little bit. I think now's the time, because you're just not seeing the same level of production, say, that you saw in that game in Dallas. Remember a couple weeks ago where they were dominant 5-on-5 early in the game? You haven't seen that level of play in the last few weeks.
And like we've said before, Dave, as long as the Jets keep winning, I mean, I don't know if you need to change the lines. I'm just saying, I mean, I'd like to see Scheifele and Laine together, because when they were together last year, they were really good. That's all I'm saying.
Food for thought. It'll be interesting to see what Paul Maurice decides to do. When we come back, more Jets conversation. Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Thank you.
25 minutes before the top of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. We're going to get Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press on the line with us. In the meantime, we'll suggest to you that this segment was brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. Dave, you were at the Moose game last night. An impressive victory for the Moose. 5-3, is that right, or is it 6-4?
6-4.
6-4 against the Chicago Wolves, including an empty net goal.
Yeah, Chase DeLeo, empty netter.
Well, there you go. So the Moose playing some good hockey as of late. They're back in action on Sunday afternoon, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, against Laval, a team that we've never seen here before.
That Laval formerly, of course, would be the St. John's Icecaps.
Right, the original. It's almost a Winnipeg Jets 2.0 situation, because that's the St. John's Icecaps, which the Moose were the St. John's Icecaps.
Yeah.
But this team was, of course, the Hamilton Bulldogs, which became the St. John's Icecaps, which now became the Laval.
There you go. Yeah. It's slightly confusing, but anyways, Laval in town on Sunday to play the Moose. Like I said, working to get Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press on the line. We remind you, you can also reach us in studio via text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. We got one texter who said, the Jets are 11-4-3. Why would you change the lines right now?
Well, and that's a fair point. And I think we're just talking about, it's about tweaking, because you want an optimum lineup. And as you talked about, Drew, it's about 5-on-5 play and not just, you can't just have one aspect of your game working, and you're trying to just continue to dominate games and impose your will on games and not just kind of tread water. So again, I agree, the team is very good. We're just spitballing, because as players like Matthew Perreault get back in the lineup, you're not going to keep Matthew Perreault on the fourth line, as we touched on.
Let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Winnipeg Free Press, we're pleased to welcome back to the program Mike McIntyre. Mike, good morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning, guys. Bright and early.
Bright and early. We've already been up for a good couple hours at this point in time. So.
This is your wake-up call, Mike.
Yeah, we're a radio show and wake-up call service. You know?
This is the kind of a lot I can think of, absolutely.
Mike obviously brought you on to talk about the Winnipeg Jets, the 11-4-3 Winnipeg Jets after their victory on Thursday night against the Philadelphia Flyers. You know, we were talking about this off the outset of the show at the top of the hour, Mike, and is it really sort of emblematic of how this might be a bit of a different Winnipeg Jets team, in that their reaction to being down 2-0 on Thursday night wasn't one of panic, it wasn't one of fire wagon hockey, it was one of continue to maintain your structure, chip away, and hope that you eventually get the opportunity to tie the game?
Yeah, you hit on it right there, that they didn't open the game wide up, because I think Winnipeg Jets teams of the past, maybe even Winnipeg Jets teams of the first couple games of this season, I think would have perhaps hit the panic button. And even Paul Maurice yesterday, I asked him specifically about that, if he's seen this sort of growth from his team. And he admitted, he actually had a good line. He said that in the past, there were probably games where once they fell down 2-0, the 5-on-5 game, he said, would start to look what that 3-on-3 overtime looked like the other night, as in wide open trading chances. And part of that is why the Jets had such an atrocious goals against, I think, for so long, because they would open that game up when maybe it didn't need to happen. So whether it's that they've learned some patience, that they don't need to go out and erase a 2-goal deficit on one shift, that they can continue to chip away. I think we saw that maturation the other night, and obviously it paid off for them by tying it up in the last minute as they did, and then pulling it off in a shootout. Definitely a positive sign of growth for this year's Jets team.
Mike, are you surprised that Paul Maurice is going back to Connor Hellebuyck for this afternoon's game, or does it make sense based on the way Hellebuyck has played of late?
Well, it's tough to take him out of the crease, right? I mean, he has been fantastic, and I think he gave up those 2 goals the other day in the first 5 minutes, 15 seconds. And I would say both those goals were sort of atypical of Hellebuyck this year, in that, you know, there were rebounds that were left there kind of sitting in front of him that we haven't seen him give up very much this year. I'm not saying they were bad goals on him. There were nice plays by Philadelphia, and your defense has to clear those out and all that. But that being said, after the first 5 minutes of the game the other day, I would have put big money on Steve Mason playing today no matter what. But my goodness, I mean, Connor Hellebuck absolutely locked things down the other day, and he talked about that after the game, that he basically got into a zone where he knew, I can't give up another one. We're already down two. If they get a third, our chances of a comeback are almost nil. And he was absolutely locked in. He was fantastic. And so I suppose because of that, how do you not come back? You're playing a team that right now you're tied with for third overall in the NHL in terms of winning percentage. They have an identical record. They just hung seven goals on Chicago earlier this week. Granted, they got shut out in Toronto the other night, but these guys can score, and I guess why wouldn't you go back to Hellebuck? I'm sure Steve Mason isn't exactly thrilled. This might have been a game where you get him in, and then you use Hellebuck on Monday for the big divisional game against Nashville. I think it's obvious that no matter what, we're going to see Hellebuck in that game, and probably the only game Steve Mason gets in the next little while is going to be one of the back-to-backs in California next week. But when you have a goalie going as good as Connor Hellebuck is, it would be awfully tough to take him out. And I suppose if you did and then things didn't go well, you certainly open yourself up for second-guessing, and not just from fans, but perhaps from your own team. They want to get these points piled up as early and as often as possible, and I think right now they think the best way to do that is to just absolutely ride Connor Hellebuck.
Mike, at the beginning of the season, I suspect most people would have had Brandon Tanev penciled in as the 13th forward, yet there he is on the third line, and he seems to have enmeshed himself there for the near term. You know, he's shown a willingness to, you know, give up any part of his body and sacrifice, as we saw in that penalty kill. And is that just why you think he's so appreciated by his teammates?
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, even the fan response the other day, right? Like, I can't remember which flyer hit him with that first shot on the penalty kill. And I mean, the circumstances of it, we can't understate the importance of it. It was getting late in the third period. The Jets were down 2-1. Philly was on the power play. If they score a goal there, the game is probably over. And the Jets were sort of hemmed in. Philly had good control of the puck. Brandon Tanev makes one huge shot block, and you could tell it hurt him. He wobbled. He sort of limped his way to the bench once they got the clear. And I honestly thought, okay, we're not seeing Brandon Tanev anymore tonight, because I thought that, you know, he was hurt. Well, lo and behold, like 30 seconds later on the same penalty kill, he's back out there. And what does he do? He gets in front of another shot, almost as hard. And the fans erupted. You could see the bench. I watched as he skated back. I mean, guys are sort of mugging him on the bench with high fives and head caps. And a few minutes later, the Jets go on to score the tying goal. And I'm not saying Brandon Tanev led to that, but certainly the momentum that you get from a big kill like that and his willingness to sacrifice his body. I asked him yesterday, like, are you afraid to almost take your skate off sometimes at the end of a game for fear of what you might see? And he admitted that ice packs have become his friend lately. But you're right. I mean, if Connor Hellebuck is the surprise of the season so far, and I think without a doubt he is, Brandon Tanev might be the second biggest surprise on this year's team. Who would have figured that with the Jets fully healthy, which they are right now, that Tanev would actually still be playing a prominent role on this team when guys like Sean Mathias and Marco Dano aren't even in the lineup? But his speed, his tenacity, the forecheck, and his willing to sacrifice all makes him a pretty integral part of this lineup right now.
Mike McIntyre, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Mike is obviously covering the Winnipeg Jets for the Winnipeg Free Press. Mike, you know, we were talking about the lines last segment, and now that Matthew Perreault is back in the lineup and the Jets have a fully healthy contingent of forwards, obviously Paul Maurice has some options when it comes to how he deploys his forward group. From your perspective, is it maybe time to break up that second line of Little, Ehlers, and Laine that really just hasn't been producing five-on-five all that much this season?
It's a great question, because you're right. I mean, Matthew Perreault on the so-called fourth line just does not seem like a natural fit for very long. albeit him and Joel Armia maybe have some chemistry there, and it could lead to some intriguing possibilities in that you can kind of roll four line. Let me just say this. I'll play devil's advocate. If you were to split that little line of Ehlers lineup, and let's say you move Perreault up there, where is the person who's moving down? Where are they going? Because I don't think right now you want to touch the Lowry Kopp Tanev line, which you could argue over the last couple games has been the Jets' best line. So if you're not touching that line, I mean, is Patrick Laine going down to the fourth line to play with Matt Hendricks and Joel Armia? Is Nick Ehlers going down there? Is Brian Little falling down? I mean, I just don't know where you put a guy right now. And so maybe, again, as long as they're still winning and playing well, maybe you just don't touch this lineup. You leave it like you have it right now. You get Matthew Perreault some power play time. He scored a power play goal the other day. And you hope that you get him enough ice. He is coming back after being off for quite some time. So, you know, if it means that he's not playing 16, 17, 18 minutes, so be it for now. But it's a problem that the Jets have not really had before, and I would suggest it's a very good problem right now to have, and maybe it's just one that the less tinkering, the better.
Mike, why can't Dustin Byfuglien and Jacob Trouba score any goals?
Oh, it's a great question, because these guys, I think if you look, they're shooting the puck a lot. So it's not for a lack of opportunities. Why can't Brent Burns score goals? Is something happened this year to defensemen in the league, that there's a force field or something that's been erected? It is puzzling. I don't think anybody would have pegged those guys in for zero. You know, they're still getting assists. They're helping certainly on the power play. They've both, especially Dustin Byfuglien, has had some good moments on the power play. But, yeah, I think it's just a matter of time. I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. I think if there's any concern about their game, it's not so much the lack of scoring. It's, you need them to be sort of anchors on that defense. And I would argue that both Dustin Byfuglien and Jacob Trouba have been very inconsistent so far this season. There have been games where you notice them for a good reason and you say that they're their game, and then there have been other games where they really look to have struggled. To me, Josh Morrissey, without a doubt and far and away, has been the most consistent defenseman for the Jets this year. Paul Maurice talked yesterday about one of the things with his team that gives some reason for optimism going forward, and that is that he still thinks there is so much room for improvement on what this year's Jets are doing, and I would absolutely agree with him. I don't think anybody can argue that this team is somehow overachieving, that everybody is playing to their absolute full potential, and that this is kind of the best that anybody can hope for. I would actually argue that in spite of their 11-4-3 record, there are a lot of players and a lot of nights when the team can be a lot better. And that I think should excite a lot of people, because I think there is another gear or two, another level or two that this team can go to. And I would put Byfuglien and Trouba near the top of that list as players that have that room to get better.
You know, you're not just Mike McIntyre who covers the Winnipeg Free Press, who covers the Winnipeg Jets. You also cover the Manitoba Moose. And now this is the Moose team now, Mike, that's won, as you well know, 6 of the last 7 games, sitting first in the Central. You watched this team with me last year. You've watched this team this year. What do you see as the biggest difference with this group?
Well, I think it starts on the back end. The goaltending last year was extremely solid despite the record, and the goaltending this year is fantastic again. But I think it really starts with the blue line, and last year's Moose, they really struggled to get the puck out of their own end. I mean, the breakouts at times last year were horrendous to watch. The Moose would get hemmed in. This year, the Moose have several very efficient puck-moving defensemen. Cameron Schilling would absolutely be at the top of that list. Sami Niku is having a wonderful rookie season, and man, can that kid ever skate out there? And you know, the Moose, their ability to get the puck out and to get it up to their very talented forward group, I think is number one, the biggest difference. And then, I mean, Jack Lozlevich has clearly taken another big step in his development, second in the American Hockey League in scoring, and he's 20 years old. And my goodness, we just talked for a few minutes about all the good things going on with the Jets and didn't even touch upon what's happening on the farm, where the Moose right now are tied for sixth in the American Hockey League in win percentage. The Jets are tied for third in the National Hockey League for win percentage, and they have a good one in Jack Roslovich, who is showing that he might be ready right now. The team just doesn't have a spot for him, so he'll stay on the farm for the foreseeable future and continue to tear it up. And he's not the only good piece down there. There's a lot of good pieces on this year's Moose team up front as well. But I think it really does start on the blue line and their ability to create offense that they didn't have last year. That's been the biggest difference to me.
Mike McIntyre covers the Winnipeg Jets and the Manitoba Moose for the Winnipeg Free Press. Mike, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much. We'll see you at the rink later on this afternoon.
You bet. Enjoy the day, guys.
Take care, Mike. When we come back, we'll talk about the NHL general managers meetings. We're going to get to the Jack Roslovich question. That's coming up in the second hour of this morning's show, so stay tuned for that. For now, a quick update on what's happening at the NHL general manager meetings in Montreal. That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Big thanks to Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press for joining us on the program about 7 minutes or so before the top of the hour. Adam Vingan of the Tennessean newspaper will join us at 9 this morning. Obviously, the Jets into Nashville to play their Central Division rivals for the first time on Monday evening before they head out west. So we'll be joined by Adam in about 5 to 7 minutes' time, like I said, talk about the Preds as they meet the Jets for the first time this season. This segment of the show, it's brought to you by our good friends at Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys is known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want personal, maybe you want a hoodie. Maybe you want to be a team that wears hoodies all the time. Team hoodies as you enter into your rec league game. You can visit Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com. You can check out their showroom, 982 Portage Avenue. That's the corner of Portage and Sherburn. They'll take care of all your needs as long as you tell them that Illegal Curve sent you. General managers got together in Montreal. This is always the quieter of their two meetings. They have a bigger meeting in March where they actually implement rule changes and suggest rule changes. This one was more about a little bit of glitz and glamour on the 100th year anniversary of the NHL being formed in the same hotel. I believe the Windsor Hotel in Montreal is where they conducted the meetings 100 years ago. It's where they conducted the meetings this week as well.
That's where I always stay when I'm in Montreal.
Naturally, yes. Yeah. It's not, you don't usually stay in a gutter. You stay at the Windsor Hotel.
Yep.
I'm sure it's, just they roll out the red carpet for you there, Mr. Ginsburg. Crackdown on slashing is one of the main topics of conversation. So far this season, we know that there was that, the impetus and the forcefulness put behind the slashing penalty this off season.
Yeah, the Mark Mathot, Johnny Gaudreau line.
The tap.
Yeah.
The tap is what they're trying to get rid of, where you just sort of tap a player on his thumb, and in some instances you destroy his thumb, as Crosby did to Mark Mathot last year. Slashing is by far the most called of the 10 minor penalty in the 10 minor penalties in the NHL rulebook. Heading into Thursday's game, there have been 433 slashing penalties issued. That was 112 more than tripping. The average number of power plays has increased from 2.99 last year to 3.51 after 6 weeks. More power play opportunities equal more offensive opportunities, which could explain why scoring has also increased from 2.77 goals to 3.04 goals per team per game. That, of course, from our buddy Michael Trakos at the National Post. Your thoughts on the rules, the general manager conversations, what they've been discussing in Montreal?
Yeah, and they've also been talking about goalie interference and the puck over the glass penalty. And, you know, to me, Drew, the puck over the glass is not really the big issue here.
Yeah, I'm surprised that's even still on the topic of conversation.
Well, and slashing isn't either. I will guarantee you that these slashing penalties go down, And I guarantee you the power play opportunities will go down, and I guarantee you the goals will go down.
Is that because the players will adapt or the refs will not call it as strictly as they have been through the first 6 weeks?
I think both. And I think, you know, typically, and I don't have the numbers to back this up, but goal scoring definitely goes down as the season progresses.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with these slashing penalties, guys, we saw this in the preseason. I mean, it seemed like there were 6 or 7 slashing penalties per game. Now you're seeing, what, maybe 2, 3, or 4, if that. And now I think you're going to see that to start to go down. But I do think, you know, on a season-by-season, year-over-year basis, the power plays will probably still be up as compared, you know, to the last year and the year before that, and the goals will probably be up. But to me, the bigger issue, Dave, is the goalie interference, because to me, several times this year, we just don't know what is goalie interference and what isn't goalie interference.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, Ezzy. And I think, like, we saw instances of the Jets specifically, mm-hmm. where there was goals called back and goals disallowed, and goals, and then a goal allowed against Dallas. I think it was the Jamie Benn goal, that you're sitting there going, well, I don't understand. There's no consistency. And you really have to have that. I mean, the truth is, like, even if you think about it, like yesterday, 2 days ago, sorry, on the Gudas penalty on Perreault, it was originally just going to be 2 minutes aside.
Yeah.
And then the refs, which I probably shouldn't have been doing, looked up and watched the replay.
Yeah.
And then conferred and then decided to add it, you know, make it a 10-minute, 5-minute major and a game misconduct.
And a 10-game suspension.
Yeah, well, we don't know that
yeah,
yet. But anyways, the point is that, you know, it's about consistency, and that's really key because, you know, there's nothing fans of the game hate more than watching a game and not, you know, having the game decided by the refs in a way that's inconsistent and not within the rules, and really you don't want that impacting the game, so you want it to be minimized as much as possible, in my mind, and kind of allow the flow of the game to continue.
And Dave, you don't want a 1999 Brett Hull situation happening when the playoffs come around, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And what I think is really interesting is, you know, this idea of a 1 minute penalty in overtime.
Yeah. Go on. Expand
well,
on that.
I mean,
interesting,
well,
like you're in favor
well,
of it?
Well, yeah, actually, well, you know, I think I am, because when you consider that overtime is now 3-on-3,
sure,
and it's only 5 minutes,
yeah.
I mean, why should you get a 2 minute penalty when you're playing with less players on the ice and in a shortened period?
Yeah, I'm with
Ezzy. I'm just saying it has some legs, I think.
You think that'll eventually maybe work its way into being a rule when it comes to overtime penalties?
Well, and what's interesting is if you take a penalty late in the third period.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't obviously switch it into a 1 minute penalty. It's more so if the penalty takes place in overtime, right?
That'll be interesting. It's a good question, though. You know, what happens if you take a penalty, you know, with 30
yeah.
seconds to go? Yeah. You start overtime and you're supposed to have, you know, 90 seconds left on your penalty. One of the things that, and it's never really brought up, and I don't quite understand, if you take a penalty late in overtime, as we saw happen on Thursday night.
You
shouldn't be allowed to shoot in the shootout.
It's an interesting one.
So that means Patrick Laine couldn't shoot then.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know why. So you take a penalty with, you know, 10 seconds to go in overtime or 20 seconds to go in overtime. Why should that player, that penalty just dissolve as soon as the game goes to a shootout? I think that player should not be allowed to shoot in the shootout.
How about you just dissolve the shootout?
Well, that's fine.
Generally, I agree, but the last couple of shootouts, we saw a phenomenal one with the Moose and the Jets one, I have to say, like, every goal they scored, I mean, Blake Wheeler didn't score, but every goal that was scored was very nice. Don't get me wrong, I don't disagree, and I actually agree with you, Drew. Like, I'm kind of the opinion that, look, if you take a penalty late in the game, you should be considered a player that's no longer on the bench.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like nullifying you. But the reality is, I guess they look at it, it's like it's a minor, so you slide back in.
How about this, Dave? Let's do 3 periods of the shootout and then have 5 minutes of 5-on-5.
That would work, too. Last one, real quick. Forget it. We don't have enough time. I'll talk about it later on in the show. Adam Vingan of the Tennessean is up next. We'll talk about the Predators with Adam. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number 2 of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend, Adam Vingan. Adam covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. The Jets make their first visit to Music City, USA on Monday night to meet the Preds. Adam, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Adam, are you at Tootsie's right now?
No, I actually don't spend too much time at Tootsie's. I think people, when you live here, I feel like the only time you ever really go to Broadway is if someone from out of town is dragging you there. So I've been to Tootsie's. I've experienced it, but I'm not a regular.
There you go. So there, good update on the bar scene in Nashville to start on this. I'd be concerned if it was 9 in the morning and Adam would be at Tootsie's, I got to tell you. There might be an intervention or something in your near future, Adam. Obviously brought you on to talk about the Predators. They made the biggest splash of the NHL season thus far in their acquisition and participation in that three-way trade that saw Kyle Turris end up in Nashville. How has Turris looked so far as a member of the Nashville Predators?
I think he's been quite good. His first game was his best game. He had a two-point night against the Pittsburgh Penguins last weekend. He's the fifth Predators player to have a multi-point debut for the team. And I think he's really fit in well on a line so far with Kevin Fiala and Craig Smith. I think they've been very active offensively. They're creating a lot of scoring chance opportunities. I think having a playmaking center in between those two wingers, I think, helps Fiala and Smith tremendously. Fiala scored his first goal of the season the other night against the Washington Capitals. Craig Smith is already halfway to his goal total from last season. He has 6 so far. He only had 12 last year, what was a pretty bad year by his standards and what the Predators expect of him, considering that before last season he had 3 consecutive seasons of 20-plus goals. And I think Turris has looked good. They have 1-2 punch down the middle in the top 6 that's probably unrivaled in franchise history with Ryan Johansson and Kyle Turris. I think it helps settle the center depth more evenly throughout the rest of the lineup. With all due respect to Nick Bonino, who was signed to a 4-year, $16.4 million contract July 1st to be this team's second-line center. He probably should have never been this team's second-line center. He's not that kind of player. He missed a month because of injury, but he's been playing on the fourth line in his first couple games back. But he's the quintessential third-line center, as we saw with the Pittsburgh Penguins, who won consecutive Stanley Cups with him in that role. And in that fourth line role, you could have someone like Callie Yarncroak or Colton Sissons, who have been playing together on the third line. But I think the way that Turris's acquisition is felt throughout the rest of the lineup is that it puts everybody else in a better position to succeed. And I think the Predators now have maybe forward depth they've never had before in their franchise history in terms of high-end players in the primes of their career being able to play in the right role.
Adam, in your answer there, you mentioned Kevin Fiala scoring his first goal of the year, and then you also mentioned Ryan Johansson, who scored his first goal of the year on Thursday night. How relieved is Johansson that he now has his first goal of the year, and how relieved is Peter Laviolette that his first-line center has now put a puck in the net?
Well, I think the way that it happened on Thursday in Minnesota was certainly good. It was less than 1 minute into the game, and it looked like it was a pretty harmless shot. He was just throwing it towards the net, almost parallel to the goal line, and it was able to slip through Devin Dubnyk's pads. And of course, not a great goal to allow when you had registered 3 consecutive shutouts in your previous 3 starts. But you know, Ryan Johansson was the highest paid forward in the NHL without a goal until he scored there. The problem is for Ryan Johansson is that he doesn't shoot the puck a whole lot, and that shot was the only shot he took for the rest of the, it was the only shot he took that game. So certainly good for him to get off the schneid, but still has a problem of putting the puck towards the net on his own. You know, setting up his wingers has never been an issue. But when you're making $8 million per season, you're going to need to do a lot more than take one shot on goal and hope it goes in like he did. But I think there's certainly relief there. But of course, it was spoiled by the fact that the Predators' propensity for allowing teams to cut into large leads lately finally bit them in the butt. They were up 3-0 in the second period and 4-2 in the third period and lost 6-4. You could sort of sense it coming just based on the previous 4 or 5 games because they, even though they had won five consecutive games, they weren't making it easy for themselves. Against Washington, they were up 2-0 in the first period, in a very dominant first period in which they outshot Washington 18-3, and it was tied 2-2 in the second period. 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles, they were up 3-0 in the third period, and they needed to win in overtime 4-3. Against Pittsburgh last week, they were up 3-1 in the second period. The game was tied 4-4 in the third, and they won in a shootout 5-4. So they were living dangerously during that winning streak. So the fact that it finally came up to get them, I think it was a hard lesson, but one that definitely needed to be learned.
Adam, you referenced butt in your last answer, and you know I'm going to ask about Philip Forsberg's butt, which I never thought I would do because, you know, of course, he's a goal scorer. But
we're working blue on this Saturday morning.
You wouldn't think that that would be a question about the Preds' leading scorer, but you know, you wrote about his butt checking, and I'm curious to know how a player who you know is so offensively gifted is incorporating that into his game.
Well, I think he's always had that move. I remember a couple of seasons ago. I think it was around this time, actually. It's almost two years ago, exactly. They were playing Buffalo in Buffalo, and he laid out both Josh George's and Evander Kane, I think in the same period, with one of those reverse checks. And it's sort of become his signature maneuver. And, of course, he leads the team in goals with 9 and points with 19. But, you know, as Pecorine said to me for that story, you know, he's the modern NHL player in the sense that he has a lot of skill, but he also likes to be physical. And skill players like Philip weren't always like that. They were trying to avoid the physicality, but he welcomes it. And I think, as you've seen with a lot of players, they do play better when they are physically engaged. And, you know, fans in Nashville started calling it the butt check. And I believe the official team website calls it the Fors butt. Or something along the lines of that. It's a devastating move. He catches guys off guard all the time. The example I used was last Saturday. Justin Schultz got a face full of shoulder trying to take the puck away from him. So I was just curious about how much of an element of deception there was in executing that move so properly. And he says that the surprise factor is the biggest part of it because his back is turned to the play. Defenders are coming to engage him physically, but as they're coming in with speed, he uses that momentum against them and drops them. And he's dropped a lot of guys, not just small guys, but big guys too. So, you know, I feel like he is turning into a top power forward in the NHL, and that move has certainly helped.
Adam Vingan, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Adam covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper. The Jets into Nashville on Monday night to play the Preds for the first time this year. Adam, the Predators banged up, lose a couple guys in that game to Pittsburgh last week. Scotty Hartnell is going to miss some time, and so will Yannick Weber. Which of those two injuries is more significant from the Predators' perspective?
Well, that's a good question. I certainly think... maybe Scott Hartnell at first blush, just because I think he had been playing really well. His familiarity with Peter Laviolette certainly helps, but he's been playing really well on both ends of the ice and giving them that net front presence that they were lacking really since they traded Patrick Hornquist to the Penguins for James Neal 3 or 4 years ago. A pretty fluke-looking injury. I think he just caught her right on the ice early in that game last weekend and never came back. And Yannick Weber took a pretty hard blow to the knee, making contact with Riley Sheahan during the second period of that game against the Penguins. Well, interestingly enough, he did come back. You know, I think he took one shift in the third period and then sat on the bench. But you know, neither of them, you know, seem to be showing any visible signs of discomfort. You know, I've seen them leave the arena without, you know, walking normally without any crutches or visible braces or anything like that. I mean, Yannick Weber, you know, he's been playing a third pairing role on this team, but even before the trade for Kyle Turris, when they had the surplus of depth defensemen, you know, Anthony Potato, Matt Irwin, Yannick Weber, and Sam Girard. There was a rotation going down in that bottom pairing in terms of who was in and who was out every night. And Yannick Weber was the player who was most regularly in the lineup. So they trust him in that role. But they do have a lot of depth, of course. Matt Irwin and Anthony Potato have been serving as the third pair for the last couple of games, and they're serviceable. But you don't really need them to be too much involved when you have Matthias Ekholm, P.K. Subban, and Roman Josi. And Ryan Ellis should be coming back within the next month So it will lessen the blow of Yannick Weber, who actually probably should come back maybe at the same time as Ryan Ellis, maybe sometime next month. So I do think that Hartnell's loss certainly hurts, but you know, the forward depth, as I mentioned, has been great. You know, with the addition of Turris and Pontus Aberg, who's actually on a conditioning assignment, has 4 goals in 3 games for the Milwaukee Admirals during that conditioning assignment. So when he comes back, well, he can give them some goal scoring punch, presumably.
You know, Adam, you mentioned Nick Bonino earlier, and now that Kyle Turris has been acquired from the Ottawa Senators, he's now the de facto second-line center, and Nick Bonino has been bumped down to the fourth-line center. Is that a problem, considering that the Predators signed him to a 4-year contract, or is that not a problem, and that just shows how much depth they have up the middle?
I think it's the latter, and of course, on July 1st, you're going to pay a guy a lot of money. I mean, his annual average value went from 1.9 in Pittsburgh to 4.1 in Nashville. But when you win 2 Stanley Cups and you play a large role in that first one, particularly with Carl Hagelin and Phil Kessel, you're going to get paid a lot of money. You know, Nick Bonino felt like in Pittsburgh, of course, with Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin, that he wasn't going to have the opportunity to be a top six center there, but he had one here. Of course, that was before they signed Kyle Turris, but Nick Bonino really hasn't had an opportunity to really find his role on this team because he's been in and out of the lineup. He missed the entire preseason recovering from the injury he suffered in the Stanley Cup final, a broken tibia. He skated throughout the preseason and practiced with the team, but he didn't play in any games. So he made a season debut in the season opener, in the season opener against Boston at the beginning of October, and then made it through 4+ games before getting injured against Chicago and then was out for a month. So he's really been had to start from scratch, and they've been watching him and monitoring his situational play and his minutes over the last couple games. But I think once he gets, you know, his legs underneath them again, he'll slide into that third line center role, which is really what he should have been all along. I mean, a reason why I think they really liked Nick Bonino was because in a lot of ways he replaced a lot of the play that they lost when Mike Fisher retired. They're very similar players, two-way players who can contribute on special teams and be responsible offensively and defensively. You know, Mike Fisher was playing a second-line role for this team, and so they were comfortable doing the same with Nick Bonino, but I do think that him playing a bottom-six role is best suited for his talents. I think that's where he is best used, where the offensive side of the game isn't an obligation. I do think that in the role that he was going to be playing, if he was second-line center, he was going to have to put up at least 40 to 50 points to justify the price tag, which he hasn't done in 4 years. So I do think that having him in a third or fourth line center role is better for him and them.
Adam, Nashville's been very good at home, 5-1-1, but on the road they're 5-5-1. To what do you attribute this disparity?
Well, you know what? They were never really a great road team last year either, until maybe near the end of the season. I mean, you saw how good Nashville was at home during the playoffs, winning, I think they won every home game they played in the playoffs until Game 4 of the Western Conference Final against the Anaheim Ducks. They went 9-2 at home during the playoffs. Of course, the other loss being the Stanley Cup losing loss in Game 6 to Pittsburgh. What went into the season, at least at the beginning during training camp, the one thing that players kept on saying over and over again was that they wanted to be better this season so that they could have home ice advantage during the playoffs and use it to their advantage. And, you know, think about how much better they may have been if they would have had home ice advantage, and had that 9-2 record, even better maybe against, teams during the Stanley Cup playoffs. So, they got off to a really bad start on the road. I mean, their first 2 games this season were the worst 2 games, 4-3 loss in Boston, which was not as close as the score suggested, and a 4-0 loss to Pittsburgh, at PPG Paints Arena. Those 2 games were, you know, decidedly their worst of the season. But they just finished a road trip, a 4-game road trip where they lost in San Jose, but then won in Anaheim, Los Angeles, and Columbus, which are not easy places to play or win, and the competition is tough. So I do think they're on the right track in that regard. But, of course, a game where you're on the road and up 3-0 and you lose 6-4, it leaves a sour taste in their mouth. So, you know, if you're the Nashville Predators, you're hoping that the Colorado Avalanche, who they play tonight at home you know, they come out and they're fiery and they're ready to play because, you know, a five-game winning streak certainly is nice, but the way that they lost it certainly, you know, puts a bad taste in their mouth.
Adam Vingan covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. The Jets and the Predators will do battle on Monday night for the first time this year. Adam, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
Take care, Adam. When we come back, we discuss Jack Roslovic. He's up to second overall in the AHL in points on the heels of a four-point night last night.
Jumping Jack.
Jack Roslovic, is he long for the Moose or does he belong in the Jets lineup? That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
On the ice. It's a 5-on-4. He scores! Jack Roslovic. Now out come the Moose. Left side to the center stripe. It'll bounce for Roslovic across the line. He shoots and scores! Jack Roslovic with the 2-1 goal. The Moose lead for the first time in the game.
Jack Roslovic tearing it up at the AHL level. 4 points last night, Dave. 2 goals, 2 assists for the Manitoba Moose in their 6-4 victory over the Chicago Wolves. He had 3 points in back-to-back games in Stockton and San Jose last week. So he's in his last 5 games, 10 points for Jack Roslovic, the Jets' former first-round selection. Question I have for you guys is...
What about that call from Mitchapalooza?
That's a very funny old school reference there, Ezzy. I'm glad that you were able to remember that one. That's very good. One of the underrated movies of all time, and the last time I believe Craig Kilborn was ever relevant.
Wow.
He played the skeezy boyfriend in that movie.
Yeah, he was good in that.
Yeah, he was. You haven't seen him since there. You know, his movie career never took off.
It's Guy Code, Drew.
Anyway, yeah. Jack Roslovic, guys, 10 points in his last 5 games. Like I said, he's absolutely tearing things up at the AHL level, second overall in points. And I think for the most part, everyone expected after training camp this year that Jack Roslovic was probably going to spend the majority of the year, if not all the year, at the AHL level. We know he got the one game last year where he got the call up to play at home in his in Columbus. You know, he's a hometown boy in Columbus. But at this point in time, with the numbers that he's putting up, do the Jets have to start considering that he might be playing his way out of the AHL and playing his way onto the NHL, onto the Winnipeg Jets roster?
Well, Dave Minuk is the guy that you want answering that question because Dave has watched the Moose more than anybody. And, you know, when you talk about Roslovic, Dave, we were at the draft in Florida when he was drafted 25th overall. And, you know, there was a pretty good player that was drafted a couple of spots before him. Brock Besser was drafted by the Canucks. Actually, ironically enough, Travis Konecny, who we just saw, was drafted right before Jack Roslovic. I'm not going to read the entire
first round
2015 draft order there, Drew, but you mentioned it. I mean, he's second in the AHL in scoring right now. And, Dave, I don't know if the Jets call him up in the near future, but I think that there's one thing that we all know. It's just a matter of time before he's in the NHL because the speed and the skill that he possesses is unquestionable.
Yeah, and you know the Moose are doing a lot of good things with him. I mean that's the key. They're developing him, and then that's why I think the focus fans need to pump the brakes a little bit in terms of moving him to the Jets and already slotting him into somewhere on the third line or the second line. He's already in some people's minds. He's already replacing Brian Little, and don't get me wrong, Jack Roslovic eventually, I would imagine that's the goal, is to one day replace Brian Little, but he's not going to do that tomorrow. Watch, he'll get called up tomorrow to replace Brian Little. But but the point I'm making is that, you know, I mean, maybe I'm a bit risk averse, but I think like there's a tendency in life to move people forward and want immediate results and immediate success. And the fact is you want this player to be a dominant NHL player. And we've seen so many guys go through the AHL, really kind of hone their craft as young players. I mean, remember, he's only 20 years old, so you've still got many, many good years of Jack Roslovic ahead of him. And the fact is that, you know, we've seen so many players go through the AHL, play a season or two, get that under their belt, come into the NHL, properly develop, you know, bigger, stronger, faster. I mean, it's a cliche that players generally use, but I mean, the truth is it is the truth. That's what they need to do. You need a guy to be able to, I mean, if Jack Roslovic is pinned against the boards, is Jack Roslovic going to be able to get away from a, you know, a Ryan Getzlaff, a Corey Perry, you know, that sort of that idea. Now, don't get me wrong, he is an unbelievable talent. He really is. He is the premier prospect in this organization, if you ask me. I don't think there's anybody that's even close to what Jack Roslovic possesses. He really does have that full game. So, I mean, if you're a Jets fan and you're looking to the future, you are very excited about this player. I mean, there are very few limitations to his game, and I really think those are just age-related as opposed to skill-related. I mean, and again, he really has a good sense for the puck on both ends, and I talked about it yesterday a bit in the post-game recap, but it was just, it's not just a guy who can get you points. Yeah, the 4 points sound great. You know, two goals, two assists, second in the AHL, and people point to that and they say that's phenomenal, but it's really the heads-up play that he can do in his defensive zone. And interestingly enough, I mean, Jack Roslovic is a center, but I asked him about it yesterday in the following the game about playing wing, because the Moose have made a concerted effort to move him to the wing. And for the most part of the season, for the first, I think, seven games, he played center. And then he moved just before the California road trip, he went to the wing, came back, played Belleville back at center, went to California, has been on the wing ever since, and hasn't left the wing.
And he was on the wing last night?
He was on the wing last night. So they've kind of moved him into that winger role, and I asked him about it, and he said when he played junior, like when he was younger, he was a winger there as well. So he's not just a center. I mean, people have a tendency, they see center beside his name, so that's where you pencil him in. But the reality is that Jack Roslovic, especially with his speed, and they're taking advantage of that, and is skating. They're really moving him towards that wing role, which isn't necessarily a bad thing about the versatility and being able to play both center and wing. Because for the Jets, I mean, we talked about it, right? They seem to have that kind of center depth right now locked up. So do you move him into a wing position when you get a chance to give him that opportunity?
And no one should be surprised, by the way, that Jack Roslovic is tearing up the American Hockey League. No one should be surprised, you know, just as an aside, that Dylan Strome is tearing it up if you watched him play for the Erie Otters last year, right? I remember when we were at the draft in Florida, and, you know, we were talking, you know, to some of the scouts, and they were talking about how good Jack Roslovic was playing on a line with Matthew Tkachuk and Jack Eichel for the U.S. National Team Development Program. I mean, this is a guy that could have easily gone higher in the first round, and I think right now
the
Jets have a steal at 25th overall.
If they redrafted, he would probably definitely go higher.
I think you could argue he goes top 10.
The way he's been performing, I would agree with that, because he is putting up these numbers at the AHL level at a very young age. The question I have, if they're trying to get him adapted to playing life on the wing at the pro level, isn't that maybe an indication that the team is thinking, that the organization is thinking about bringing him up to play the wing for the Winnipeg Jets at some point this season? There might not be a spot for him on the up the middle right now, but if they're getting him accustomed to playing the wing professionally, isn't there maybe a thought process that he's going to solidify that top nine forward group by slotting into the wing? Not necessarily imminently. I know he's playing very well right now, and I would agree that, you know, for the next 10, 15 games, 20 games, you probably keep him at the AHL level. But if he continues this pace going forward, and it's January and it's February and the Jets are continuing to play very well, maybe they look internally to increase their skill and increase their offense, as well as maybe seeing what's on the available via trade. And maybe this shift or this adjustment or this, you know, getting him used to playing the wing is part of that mindset.
I think there's an advantage to both teams being in the same building. I mean, the fact is that, you know, the brass can come and watch Jack Roslovic, and they can watch his development, and they can make that decision. And it's not a function of, you know, getting a report from, you know, the East Coast and having not really seen every single game. If they want, they can come and watch every single game. They can see what, because you got to remember something. These guys aren't just watching for the numbers that we see on the score sheet. These guys are watching for the intangibles. They're watching how he plays positionally. They're watching what he does away from the puck. Mm-hmm. And if he's doing those things, and he's doing it at a really significant level, then yeah, maybe that is something you do, Drew. And maybe you do look to bring him up and help him solidify your top nine and really have a strong top nine moving forward. But again, I don't know. There's no answer. There's no one-size-fits-all kind of response to that question, because you don't know that they're necessarily going to put him into that role of a top-nine forward with the Winnipeg Jets this season. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. I mean, like I said, I don't have a crystal ball. Mm-hmm. I just see what he's doing here is very important for his development long-term.
And with the way the Moose are playing right now, you know, top-five team in the American Hockey League, You know, Pascal Vincent wants to hang on to Jack Roslovic.
Sure, but they know what the point of the Moose is to be a developmental, be a feeder for the for the NHL team.
You know, and to Dave's point, Drew, I mean, there was a plan at the beginning of the season for Jack Roslovic. Now, obviously, plans can change, and the way Roslovic is playing right now, he's well over a point a game. You know, maybe he gets a call up at some point in the season, but there's always the chance that, you know, he spends an entire year with the Moose, and that's not a bad thing, because you know, at the very least, he's going to be in the NHL next year.
And the one critical point that I think is important to kind of focus on is the fact that he is playing in all situations. And he is playing in the penalty kill. He's playing on the power play. He's playing 5-on-5, obviously. And so he might not get that in the NHL. So, again, fans have to remember that, you know, you're talking about a guy who you want to be able to develop into a Brian Little-type player. And again, you know, we saw it watching the game the other day where he picked the pocket of a guy at the blue line, went in on a breakaway, didn't score, but it was very emblematic of what Brian Little had done against Oliver Ekman-Larsson when Arizona was in town, stole that puck. Now Brian Little scored, but the fact is that you see Brian Little in Jack Roslovic. It's almost like a Brian Little light right now, and the fact is he's molding into that. But again, he's not Brian Little. I mean, we all talk about how much, you know, we respect Brian Little as a player and how kind of undervalued he is around the league. So you can't just become that. You know what I mean? You can't just say, well, he's going to be that guy. He's not there yet. But again, like I said, this guy is a blue chip prospect for this organization.
It'll be interesting to see how the Jets handle Jack Roslovic going forward, especially if he continues to produce at this point level, something to clearly keep an eye on as the season unfolds both at the NHL and AHL level. When we come back, Alex Pruitt of Sports Illustrated is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.